What is the technique we're doing today? What's it called?
Electrophoresis?
Yes, specifically gel electrophoresis. There's other kinds of electrophoresis that don't use gel. They use something else, but gel is the common type. Electrophoresis in general is a separation technique, one of several separation techniques. We've already talked about at least one separation technique. What other things are separation techniques? Right. Spinning to separate things is called centrifugation. And that separates things, of course, on the basis of their mass, different masses, right? Heavier things will be forced to the bottom, and that will displace things that are lighter, and that's why they go up. They're all trying to go down, but the heaviest stuff wins out. Like if you were to drop a really heavy weight into one of those ball pits that kids play in, it would go to the bottom and the lighter ones would go up. Distillation is another separation technique. That's how we make booze. You make the alcohol originally from fermentation, but the organism, the yeast that ferment, can only make alcohol so strong before it starts killing them. If you want it stronger than that, then you have to distill the stuff. That's not the only use of it, but distillation separates things on the basis of different things having different boiling points. So if you have a mixture of stuff, you want to separate them, you very gradually bring it up in temperature, and the stuff with the lowest boiling point will come off first, separating it from the rest, and so on. Electrophoresis, on the other hand, is separation of things based on three different criteria, one of which is charge, one of which is size, and one of which is shape. They all three matter, and they're all three important, but I guess you could say that the most important of them is charge, simply because if you have a mixture of particles and none of them is charged, electrically charged, then electrophoresis is not your technique, because none of them is going to separate from each other. At least some of them have to be charged. In gel electrophoresis, as you know, because you just loaded one, you have a gel, and the chamber that I put the gel in is an electrophoresis chamber. And the liquid that's in that chamber is called buffer. It's not pure water, which wouldn't work very well because pure water doesn't conduct electricity very well. But it has salts in it. And salts are electrolytes. They conduct electricity. So that allows for there to be a voltage applied. There's two electrodes in there, a black one and a red one. The black one's negatively charged compared to the red one, which is positively charged. So you put the gel in that chamber so that one end of the gel has a negative charge and one end has a positive charge. Well, if you have a bunch of particles in your sample, different types of particles, for instance, and none of them is charged, then they're not going to move because uncharged particles aren't attracted to either positive or negative end of the well. So you have to have at least some of your particles be charged if you're going to use gel electrophoresis. And once you turn on the power supply, which creates that voltage across the length of the gel, then any negatively charged particles will move toward the positive end, because negatives attract positive, and any positive charged particles will move toward the negative end. And any uncharged ones, if there are, will just stay where you put them, which is in the well. You start by putting all your particles, which is a mixture in your sample, in a well, right? That's what you already did. Well, notice that we used a gel that has all 15 wells are at one end of the gel. But you can make it any way you want. You can put that comb, I was telling you, when you pour the liquid material before it sets up, you can put that comb anywhere you want. So you could, for instance, have wells right in the middle of the length of the gel instead of at one end. Now, when would it be appropriate to do that?
You have both negative and positive charges, you want to separate them each way.
That's exactly right. When you either know that you have both negative and positive, or it could be either and you don't know. In other words, when you need to have room to move in either direction, then you would put them in the middle. We didn't do that, though. We put them all at one end. And the reason that we did that is because even though we don't know what the results are going to be, we know that all of the particles, which is all DNA pieces, are going to move in one direction. Why do we know that? Why do we know that DNA is always going to move in a certain direction rather than the other direction? Well, the only way you could know that about a particle is if you know what the charge is. And notice that I put the gels in there so that the well was back toward the wall. Notice on there that that's at the black end, which is the negative end. So it would be like this. The wells are at the negative end. The positive end is the other. In other words, I put it in there because I know that since we're working with DNA, the DNA is going to move toward the positive end. What does that say about DNA? It's negatively charged, and that's true no matter where you get the DNA from. That's why we can be confident and put our wells at one end. Why do we know that DNA, regardless of where it comes from, is negatively charged? What is it that makes DNA negatively charged? Did you say something? So you did say something, and it was the right answer. Yeah, DNA is a polymer made out of nucleotides, right? However many nucleotides. But regardless of how long a piece you have, it is nucleotides. And every single nucleotide, in order to be a nucleotide, has to have a phosphate in it, right? A phosphate has negative charges on it. Therefore, regardless of the DNA, whether it's from a giraffe, a bacterium, anything else, an owl in your case, no matter how long or short it is, it's negatively charged, and therefore it's always going to move toward the positive end. Now, I would have ruined the experiment if I would have accidentally turned this around. If I'd have put it in so that the wells are at the positive end, the red end, and negative's down here, then the DNA would just move right off the short edge of the gel, and they would no longer be there. They would just be in the liquid. So you have to pay attention to how you load the things, what I'm saying. But anyway, what we're calling lanes, what you labeled that lane sheet for, is that every well corresponds to a lane. You don't see the lanes, but it's like the lanes in a swimming pool. And the well is where you put your sample, of course. The sample is many, many particles. Whether they're different kinds of particles or not, there's a population of particles. And they're like runners in a race, or swimmers in a race. Meaning they all start out at the same position, and they're all going to move in the same direction, because they're all DNA. But the reason they're going to separate from each other is that they're going to move at different speeds. So they all start together in the well. They move at different speeds, and therefore they will move away from each other depending on how much of a difference in speed they're traveling at. Well, this brings up the other two things that matter besides charge. Charge has to be there for them to move at all, but how fast they move is determined by shape and size. Now, if you imagine actually, instead of swimming, just walking through a swimming pool with water up to your neck, it's really much a lot harder than walking in air, which we're used to, right? You're not going to be nearly as fast, which is kind of what's happening there, because gel is kind of is viscous and thick. It's hard to move through. And a bigger person is going to have more of a trouble walking through water than a smaller person, because the bigger body is more resistance, you know, moving through that viscous medium. But even one person whose size doesn't change from moment to moment can make it easier by being compact, or you could slow yourself down by walking through the pool spread out like this, right? That's why shape also matters. Size and shape both matter. Well, the shape is not really an issue here, because all the fragments of DNA are basically the same shape. So really what matters as far as how fast they go is just the size. And what's important to remember, because a lot of people mix this up in their mind for whatever reason, is that the bigger the particle is, the slower it will be. And when we finally look at our gels after this is run, we'll see what are called bands. A band will look like just a little line segment in the lane. And if you have more than one size of particle, then you'll have different bands in the same lane. And what I'm saying is important to remember is that since the bigger ones are slower, that means the one that moves the farthest is the smaller one. The band farther away from the well is smaller. The band closer to the well is bigger. Now, a band is not a particle. If you had just a single piece of DNA in your well, you would never see it. It would be there, it would move, but it would not be enough to see, even when we put it in that machine over there, which I'll describe in a minute. It's just not enough to be visible. Instead, it's millions of pieces of DNA, all of the same size. And they therefore all move at the same speed, so they stay together, and there's enough of them for us to see it as a band. But if you, at the same time, in the same sample, have millions of copies of another size, they will move at a different speed and they will form a different band. All right? Now, in this experiment, there should be either one or two bands, not zero or three or any other number. And that's because of how we set the experiment up. We were using owl DNA, right? You chose two owls last time, or the DNA from two owls. And I didn't mention it when I was talking about PCR, which amplified the DNA, of course. But PCR does not amplify the entire DNA that's in your sample originally. It doesn't make millions of copies of that entire length. It only copies a certain part within that length that it's looking for, in a sense. Remember the ingredients that I had to add to your tubes, which are raw materials, nucleotides and so on? It also included primers. Primers that were designed to look for a specific sequence. So the primers are specific for the experiment. They're designed for it. The primer is a sequence of DNA, but whatever that sequence is in the primer, which is in the ingredients, that is looking for, so to speak, a complementary sequence in the DNA. And until it finds it, if ever, it will just ignore it. Once it finds that complementary sequence, that's where it will bind and start elongating. So in other words, PCR looks for a specific subset of the overall length of your sample and makes copies of just that segment. Okay? Now, in the case of your owls, we were using DNA from sex chromosomes. And we haven't talked about sex determination mechanisms yet upstairs, but we will. Humans and birds are similar animals when it comes to sex determination. They both use sex chromosomes, to determine the sex. And in both of these species, the animal uses that has two different versions of a sex chromosome. In humans, as you may already know, there's an X chromosome and there's a Y chromosome. And chromosomally, a female is a person that has two X chromosomes, whereas a male has one X and one Y. Birds have basically the same way of determining the sex, except they don't have XY chromosomes, they have Z and W. Plus, it's reversed with respect to which one has two of one and one of each. In birds, the male has two Zs, and the female has a Z and a W. Otherwise, it works the same way. Okay, but so you randomly chose two birds, and you don't know what sex they were. But if it was a male, the DNA would have been all one kind because it would have been two Zs that it's taken from. If it was a female, you have two different sequences of DNA that was in your sample, one from a Z, one from a W. And on page 146, it shows you that the yellow segment, which is the segment that the primers designed for, that were in the ingredients of the PCR mixture, the primers are looking for that yellow segment. And that's what gets amplified, not the entire blue length. Okay? What that means is after you make millions of copies, if you chose a male bird, you'll have millions of copies all the same length. And therefore, when you electrophorese it, it should be one band. In a female, you'll get two different lengths, millions of copies of each, but there'll be two different lengths. And notice that the W chromosome has a shorter fragment in it that's looked for by the PCR than the Z. Therefore, if you chose a female, it should band out with two bands, not just one. Is that all clear? So this would be a female, if that's what you see, two bands. Right next door, what would a male look like? One band, but where compared to this one? That's exactly right. You have only long ones for a male, and therefore it would be even with the long one of the female, and there wouldn't be any short ones. That's really all it is today for as far as understanding the process. Now, I probably haven't talked long enough for this to go, but I still have a couple more things to say about how you would carefully do this. Time is a variable that's important also in electrophoresis. The longer you let this thing run, of course, the longer they are running the race. And therefore, the faster ones will get from the shorter ones, from the slower ones, I mean, right? The more the separation will be, in other words. Well, if you don't let this run long enough, then even if there are two different bands, you won't see them as two different bands because they won't separate enough. So you let it run longer. You don't want to let it run too long, though, because if you just keep it going overnight, they'll all just spill off the other end, the far end, and they'll be gone. Well, the problem with it, so you want to adjust it, you want to adjust the time so that you can maximize the separation without losing any of the bands. But the problem is, and you can come up here and look at it, is that the bands are invisible while it's running. You don't see any DNA bands because it requires, the bands of DNA do not show up in this, the way we have it set up, unless you illuminate them with ultraviolet light. And that's because of an ingredient in the gel that the DNA reacts with. If you have a position where there's DNA and the gel material, it will make it glow under UV, and it won't glow otherwise. But in normal light, you won't see anything, just like you don't see it right here. In other words, you're flying blindly in a sense, not knowing whether things are spilling off or not. Except that you had that orange loading die. That's the importance of that. The orange is visible, and if you come up here and look at it, you'll see that there is a what's called a dye front. It's just a yellow line that goes all the way across the gel because every one of you used the same loading dye. And you can tell how far that is from the edge. But also importantly, the loading dye is made up of a bunch of molecules that are the same as each other in size, but they're all smaller than the smaller fragment of DNA in your sample. In other words, the dye molecules run faster than either of your DNA samples. And therefore, they're winning the race. And you can that allows you to set the time so that you run it until the dye front gets to the other end. As long as there's still the dye there, you know that all your DNA is behind it. But by letting it get as close to the edge as possible, you're maximizing the separation. Now, you want to carefully do that in an experiment which, you know, not all electrophoresis trials have just two bands. Some of them have many bands. And so it would be very important to get them maximally separated. Here, I'm not going to make you sit here until this gets all the way to the end. But I'm going to let it go a few more minutes to separate it a little more. Anyway, that's what the dye front's all about. The completed gel, like I said, you won't see anything until we put it into this, is put into this machine. This is a transilluminator, which just means shining through. It has ultraviolet lamp in it, which would be dangerous to, I mean, that would harm your eyes, which is why it has a safety switch. Even if you have the lamp on and open it up, it'll immediately turn off the UV, so it's safe. But anyway, there's just a little platform in here, as you see, which once I let it run a little bit longer, I will take the gel out, put it in here. You'll see it on the screen. I'll close the door, turn on the UV light, and it should glow. So you just need to find your lane to see what your results. Let's let it go a little bit more, though, before we do that.